It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now, the U.S. is sending more arms and military equipment to Ukraine to turn the tide in Russia's war. We check in as the State Department announced this week the U.S. has now committed over $17.5 billion in security assistance to Ukraine since the beginning of the Biden administration. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said at a press briefing last week, Ukrainians are being taught how to use NATO standard equipment and maintain it.
Ukraine wants and needs is a strong defensive and deterrence system that makes it less likely in the future that Russia will act aggressively toward Ukraine, and that if it does nonetheless do that, that Ukraine is very well prepared.
Join our conversation about the war 7 months in, 800-642-1234. Ted Gerber is a sociology professor at UW-Madison, where he directs the Wisconsin-Russia Project at its Center for Russia, East Europe, and Central Asia. Ted, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be back.
And Lowell Barrington is here, associate professor of political science at Marquette University. Lowell, welcome to you.
Thank you. Good morning, Kate.
Good morning. I want to first take stock with both of you. Lowell, you first. What is most concerning to you about Russia's invasion at this point? What you see and hear?
I think while the chances seem still pretty slight to me, at least, I think the growing discussion of the use of tactical nuclear weapons has to be at near the top of the list for that. I think the people around Vladimir Putin, unfortunately, have been suggesting that to him more and more as the conventional army situation is continuing to go very badly for them in Ukraine.
Ted, how do you measure Putin's nuclear bluster and his threats?
Well, I agree that it is certainly a very serious concern. And I certainly agree with the statement that Biden made last night that we currently face a greater risk of the use of nuclear weapons, perhaps, than we have since the Cuban Missile Crisis. I would add that the situation, apart from the use of nuclear weapons, the situation is very volatile, in my view, and the view of many others within Russia itself. And that, you know, the war in Ukraine is horrible, and we hope that will come to an end. Although it's hard to see a scenario where it will come to an end anytime soon. But looking forward, also I think the situation within Russia is quite likely to deteriorate into widespread social conflict, political chaos, and perhaps even civil war, something along those lines.
You know, Ted, last time we talked, we had some discussions initially about sanctions, I recall, and just saw that the European Union has agreed on its eighth package of sanctions against Russia. What impact are these having?
Well, the sanctions have been disappointing to some. Some observers have commented, and I think rightly so, that the Russian economy has been surprisingly resilient in the face of sanctions. However, the time is, as time elapses, that is changing. So Russia faces tremendous longer-term structural issues in terms of its economy, its the productivity of various industries. The mobilization that Putin announced a little over a week ago is also contributing towards the economic decline. I think the sanctions are increasingly going to be seen, or the impact of the sanctions will increasingly be seen. They've had some effect already so far, perhaps disappointing to those who expected a really rapid decline in Russia of the economy. But I think we will be seeing an accelerating impact of sanctions as we move forward, starting already. Thanks.
Yes. Lowell, how about you? What do you see in terms of sanctions as we also watch the fighting on the ground? The conversation around sanctions initially was very robust in trying to stop this war.
Yeah, I would agree with Ted. I think they've been effective and will be increasingly effective if we maintain them over time. I think one of the concerns is while this alliance against Russia and its actions in Ukraine has held incredibly well so far, I mean, to way beyond, I think, what a lot of people's expectations were, that as winter drags on and, you know, energy situations worsen in Europe, I think there's always a fear that maybe that breaks a little. So the announcement of new sanctions from Europe is a positive sign in that way. I would also add something just to what was just said. I mean, the situation in Russia is incredibly volatile right now, and this personalist autocracy that Putin oversees, that kind of system is really fragile underneath. So it looks really strong. But one of the things as you look at these kinds of systems in history is sometimes, at least when they start breaking down, they collapse very quickly. And I think we need to be concerned about that because as much as I think a lot of people would love to see Putin not in power, the uncertainty of what would come after him is something we really need to think about. I don't think the situation necessarily at least improves if he is not running Russia.
We're talking about recent developments in the Russia-Ukraine war. Lowell Barrington there, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette. Ted Gerber with us, Sociology Professor at UW-Madison, directs the Wisconsin-Russia Project. You can join in on this war, 800-642-1234. What concerns you about the recent developments, the talk around nuclear weapons, the latest sanctions, and the fighting on the ground? Lowell, you know, on Wednesday, Putin signed paperwork to annex four regions of Ukraine to Russia, insists, you know, that it has annexed parts of Ukraine. And I'm just wondering, this seizure is against international law. Are there territories in Russian control with this annexation?
Well, this is one of the problems for Putin is that Russia does not control the full territory that they are claiming right now and, in fact, have been losing badly in some of these areas. One of the really new developments, important developments in the last week has been the improvement of Ukraine's situation on the ground in the southern part of the region that's being annexed around Kherson. And that if they are able to take that city in that region, which I think is actually quite possible now, again, that would be a big blow to Putin. And by the way, just to mention, it is, by the way, his birthday today, his 70th birthday. I think it's not, for lots of reasons, a terribly happy birthday for him today.
Thank you for bringing that up. Ted, what do you make of the annexation and this push, the counteroffensive in the country's south and east?
Well, it was quite chilling to watch a video of Putin's speech from last week, where he announced this annexation and he had this grand celebration. Clearly, he has in mind or he had hoped that this would perhaps have a similar effect within Russia in terms of his support within Russia as the annexation he carried out in Crimea back in 2014. But also, as Lowell rightly pointed out, really, it's kind of absurd to try to annex territories where you don't even control the entire territory militarily. And in fact, you're every day losing more and more ground. I was pleased to see the widespread, almost universal, with the exception of North Korea, rejection of this annexation. Also, I would note that the faces on the audience in that big speech were very grim. So he had a sort of who's who of the Russian political and economic elite in the audience when he made the speech, and nobody looked terribly happy. In fact, I think we're going back to the Soviet Union now, where we're the Soviet era, where we are reading the faces of Kremlin insiders. But it was quite a dramatic and absurd moment.
Ted Gerber, sociologist at UW-Madison studying Russia and Ukraine. Lowell Barrington with us, political scientist at Marquette University. Join in on the social, the economic, the geopolitical consequences of this war. What Moscow is capable of at this point in its war against Ukraine, sham referendums, annexing territories, 800-642-1234. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We take stock of the invasion of Ukraine 7 months in, how U.S. and NATO countries have responded with arms, military equipment, and this week with Russian President Vladimir Putin raising nuclear threats. Join in on the economic, the diplomatic, the military response to this war by the U.S. and the world. 800-642-1234. UW-Madison sociologist Ted Gerber is here. Marquette University political science scientist Lowell Barrington as well. Let's bring on a call Marcus in Milwaukee. Marcus, what would you like to bring up?
Good morning. So Vladimir Putin tells a story about himself in his autobiography, growing up in St. Petersburg, where he corners a mouse and the mouse has no way out, so it jumps at him. And this is a story he tells about his own childhood. I would say from that story, we could gauge that Vladimir Putin is potentially capable or willing to do whatever if he feels like he's caged. I was born in 79, and there was a concept during the Cold War called MAD. It stood for Mutually Assured Destruction. As for atomic weapons and playing with, it doesn't work out well for anyone. Atomic power plants and atomic weapons are not, never have been, and never should be seen as something to be played with like a child's toy. Period. End of story.
Marcus, thank you. Lowell, what do you make of those reflections?
Well, Marcus has a good point about that story. It is something that we're always concerned about with a leader like Putin about, you know, to what extent do you push back as you need to, but be concerned about when he has no option out, what he may resort to. I think the mention of the mutual assured destruction concept is important as well, because we've seen that play out a bit on our side in the rhetoric from not just people like President Biden, but even other analysts really trying to lay out for Russia what will happen if they use nuclear weapons. And I think one of the only reasons I'm concerned about the possibility is that if it happens, in terms of how likely it is, I mean, if it happens, it would mean NATO, I think, inserting itself directly into this war. I think we would see a NATO action in Ukraine at that point. And that might be what Putin wants. That's kind of the only reason he might have to think about doing this, would be if he actually wants to try to turn this into a Russia-NATO war. And I think that would be one way to possibly make that happen.
Ted, what do you make of that type of NATO escalation? Can you see that as plausible?
Yes, it's certainly plausible in the event that Putin were to resort to some kind of tactical nuclear attack. And I also, however, think it's important to indicate that the fact that Putin is making these threats very overtly, while it is very, of course, frightening to everyone, and I also remember the mutually assured destruction concept. At the same time, it's not clear how there's any other option for NATO and the U.S. to respond other than to continue to press support for Ukraine, continue to try to counter Putin's aggression. I mean, it's not really a conceivable option that the U.S. would back down and say, okay, well, since you're threatening a nuclear attack, then we're going to, force the Ukrainians to negotiate, which is basically what the Russians are asking for. And so it is very important that the American and NATO alliance leaders are planning for various scenarios, planning a massive response and communicating, as they have been, to the Russians, what kinds of severe consequences Russia will face should they resort to a nuclear attack.
I think that echoes what Secretary of State Antony Blinken said last week, that with Russia, they think through every eventuality that could happen in the State Department and plan for it. Let's go to Carol in Milwaukee now. Carol, hi.
Hello. I think we should think about what we are doing. And not only we, but as they say, it involves the whole world. I mean, not the whole world, half the world, that agree with the United States. So we have a huge problem. Our problem is much bigger than Russia. Russia is another terrible leader, has another terrible leader, which is true in many countries. But our response is incorrect, I believe. I think we should not spend $17 billion, which we don't have, on a war, which is not even in our territory. And we should not try to dominate a country like Ukraine. We should allow people to be on their own. And if it doesn't work out, that is not our fault. We are not, as many people have said, the police of the world.
Carol, thank you. Lowell, go ahead.
Well, this is a really valid point that some people hold who have seen the U.S. Engaged around the world in different kinds of situations, including involving the country in wars overseas, and they have concerns about that. The problem with a leader like Putin is he knows history, but he's also, we need to be thinking about that history as he does. And one of the big lessons from history is with someone like this, you need to stand up. You need to take a stand. And while $17.5 billion is a lot of money, it's actually far less than we're going to have to spend on supporting with other countries the reconstruction of Ukraine at the end of the war. And I think that's also something we need to get ready for, because we do not want Ukraine at the end of the war left on its own to try to rebuild its country and what that might mean for it economically and politically.
Carol, thank you for that. Shelley in Burlington, go ahead. Shelley, hi.
Hi. And just as a comment on the last caller, I guess I would chip in that Ukraine is actually a democracy that asked for our help. And I don't know how we can't come to their defense. But my question was, is it possible, or is anybody, considering that maybe Putin annexed the territories that he knows he's not in control of, to claim that Ukraine is now actually invading Russia, and that using that as further justification for, worse actions, using nuclear bombs, or, justifying it either internally in Russia or
turning the tables on
the rest of the world.
Ted, can you feel that?
Yes, absolutely. I do think that is one of his motivations, and I think it's quite misguided. I it's hard for me to imagine a scenario where, as a result of these annexations, all of a sudden the Western alliance would decide, well, okay, now that this is Russian territory, we can no longer back the Ukrainians in conducting military attacks. I also think another motive is to mobilize, to basically force residents, male residents in these annexed territories to serve in the Russian military or on the Russian side. We already know that there have been units formed, that already this process is starting. That's another motive in annexing the territory, is that it gives sort of a, but I also think, this Putin is going to do what he's going to do. And it's very hard from a Western policy perspective to try to cater your policies towards trying to modify his actions. And I think the strategy of the West so far has been to try to keep up the pressure, but in a slow fashion. That is not to not to cause a sudden dramatic decline in Russia's military fortunes, but to gradually chip away with sanctions, with diplomatic pressure, and with military pressure, to avoid the kind of cataclysmic defeat of Russia that might in the short term lead to a dramatic reaction such as the use of nuclear weapons.
We're short on time, Lowell, but are Russian forces getting new military capabilities? I mean, there have been reports in the news about drones coming from Iran. Who are Russia's allies at this point in the war?
Well, Iran is one of them, although I will say some of the countries that they're most concerned with in terms of keeping close ties to have been much quieter in the last month or so of the war as it's gone worse and worse, and that includes countries like China. I would also add that on the weapons supply question, Ukraine has benefited tremendously from its successes recently because Russians have been retreating so quickly that they are not only leaving behind guns and ammunition and massive amounts of artillery shells and things that Ukraine is now then using to further push ahead with its attacks. They've been leaving tanks and things because they were leaving so quickly they didn't have time to refuel their tanks. I mean, this was just a complete chaotic retreat in a bunch of these areas. So while Ukraine is very happy to get our initial and additional aid in terms of military support, the Ukrainian Defense Ministry actually tweeted out a day or two ago that Russian troops are now becoming the major supplier of weapons to the Ukrainian military.
Lowell and Ted, thank you so much for the update and for joining us with your insights.
Thank you, Kate.
Thank you.
Ted Gerber, professor of sociology at UW-Madison, also director of the Wisconsin-Russia Project for UW-Madison Center for Russia, East Europe, and Central Asia, and Lowell Barrington, associate professor of political science at Marquette University. Up ahead, what can unmarked graves teach us about forensic investigations? We hear from UW-Platteville researchers about a new project. Join in, 800-642-1234. News update and a story from Wisconsin Life are next on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Tyler Ditter with a story about a veteran whose world opened up after joining the military.
Lori McNeil Saylor of Kenosha knew before she graduated high school that she wanted to see the world. She was ready for something different, for new experiences outside of her childhood home in Alabama. So she joined the Navy, traveled the globe, and made lifelong friends from many cultures along the way. Saylor's daughter, Erica Saylor, interviewed her about her experiences as part of StoryCorps' Military Voices initiative.
My name is Lori McNeil Saylor. I am 59. I am also located in Kenosha, Wisconsin. I was originally born in Kalamazoo, Michigan. I moved to Mobile, Alabama after my mom passed. I was 4. And this wonderful woman named Alice adopted me. She already had 4 kids, my siblings. We grew up outside a lot, playing together, running around barefoot, just doing kid stuff. When did you enlist? I wanted to be somewhere other than Alabama. My thought process was I didn't want to go into 13th grade, as I put it, because I didn't want to go to school with the same people that I went to high school with. I wasn't really comfortable with a lot of those people. Mm-hmm. I was a lot shyer then. So when they came to the school, it sounded interesting and I signed up.
What was basic training like?
You know, it was so different because now you're living with people from all over the country. I think that's where my interest in learning about other people came from, because there were, I said, people from different cultures. And I remember this one young lady, she was just this tiny little curly haired blonde. And she asked me, can I touch your hair? And I looked at her and I was just like, sure. And afterwards she said, why is your hair different from mine? And I said, because that's the way God made it. And she was like, oh, it was so easy for her to understand that.
Is there someone that you served with you remember fondly?
My two most favorites are your Aunt Flo and your Aunt Trina, because I met one on the bus and the other one in boot camp, and we've been friends for over 30 years.
How do you think your time in the military affected you?
It opened my eyes a great deal as far as education, how to save money, just things that I hadn't really learned yet. You know, it gave me a lot of opportunities, you know, semi-free education, traveling. It definitely opened up my world and gave me the travel bug. That's the one thing I think is probably one of the most awesome things that the military did for me. I was there when they first put women on board ships. I was there when the Cold War ended, when Russia came to Norfolk, Virginia. I got to see that, you know, and I think I still have a Coke bottle with the Russian writing on it. So there are things that I got to see and experience that a lot of people don't get to do. So,
and you never would have.
Right. So I'm very grateful for the things that I was able to accomplish in the military.
Do you have any advice for someone who is interested in joining?
I believe traveling, learning about other cultures, it's probably the best thing that you can do for your own sense of being. It helps you open up your mind and your eyes, and you get to learn so much. So definitely education, travel. And I always tell them, find someone you want to emulate when you first join. Find someone that you would like to be like, and you follow them around. You ask them questions. You learn from them. you know, just absorb it all, make it worthwhile.
Right.
So I wish someone had told me that when I was joining, but I figured it out on my own.
Yes, you did. Yes, you did. Yes, you did.
That was Lori McNeil Saylor of Kenosha, Wisconsin. She shared her experience as part of StoryCorps' Military Voices Initiative, which is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Tyler Ditter.
It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now to the interdisciplinary approach of the forensic investigation degree at UW-Platteville and new research into how to locate clandestine graves, these unmarked sites containing remains. We explore its mock crime scenes and research through its Crime Scene House outdoor research facility. Join in on the future of forensics education, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Patrick Burns is Assistant Professor of Computer Science and Software Engineering at UW-Platteville. Patrick, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
And good morning. And Sarah Goetz is here, Assistant Professor of Forensic Investigation at UW-Platteville, coordinates its Criminal Justice and Forensic Investigation Program. Sarah, welcome to you.
Good morning, and also thank you for having us.
Yes. Sarah, let's start with you. Tell us about clandestine grave documentation. Explain your research on unmarked graves.
Absolutely. So as you already mentioned, the focus of this project was on finding graves that are often created in secret with the intent to conceal and in remote locations. So the focus in the forensic community the past few years has been on finding fast, effective, and easy to implement ways to search large areas fairly quickly. So that's our ultimate goal of this project. But the work that Patrick and I have been doing these last 11 months is really just the start of this process. Our goal was to create a research site, to begin collecting the data, to form this collaboration between forensic investigation and computer science, and perhaps most importantly, to start involving students in real-world applications and getting them out with the field with us to help answer this problem.
What does out in the field look like? Can you explain this research site, how it's set up? Because you also have an indoor facility as well.
We do. So our indoor facility, I guess, to start is a two-story house created by students for students through the UW-Platteville Construction Management Program. And so it's a real house that we use for processing indoor crime scenes. But when we teach indoor crime scenes, we also want to show that those principles can be taken outdoors. And so we need to translate the principles of crime scene processing to things like finding graves. So our research site is in a 1.5-acre fenced field, and we created three clandestine graves. So we dug three holes at three different depths, each with a pig to simulate decomposing human remains. And next to each grave, we had a pit of the same depth, so at 18, 27, and 36 inches. And this allowed us to figure out which changes were because of just digging a hole and altering the soil versus which ones were actually from decomposition. So we monitored each area with a small wireless probe to figure out how much water was in the soil and its temperature, and that was powered by a small solar panel. And then we also were able to compare that to temperature data, rainfall, and the soil temperature and moisture in an area where we've never dug before. So students went out and monitored those sites looking for changes in vegetation and on the surface, and we also monitored them via aerial drone.
That's a really good handoff here, I think, to Patrick. How can drones help find these unmarked graves, and what do they add to this research?
Well, they add a lot in the easy to implement side of things. So law enforcement is increasingly having this technology available to them. Lots of law enforcement agencies regularly have these drones. And we can quickly deploy them into the field and scan an area and record video at the same time. So we have that data for the future. The problem with that is that video can be enormous. So this drone that we have, it's a relatively inexpensive drone, but it records high definition video at 4K. Records at about a rate of 30 frames per second. So the amount of video that we get in even a 20-minute flight is enormous. So the question then is, how do we use that to boil it down? How do we provide information from that huge amount of data into a quick and easy way to digest? So that's the focus of my end of the research.
Yes, I mean, digesting this data, Sarah, and what you're looking for, how does the aerial view impact what you can do in forensics?
So if you were to come out to our research site and stand in the field, we've noticed changes in the vegetation and our ability to actually see the graves, to see the soil on the surface over time. But the longer the graves are in the ground, the harder it is to see things that are just a couple of feet in front of your face. But if you get up 50 or 100 feet, those patterns begin to emerge. So the graves themselves, whether we're digging an empty pit or we actually have a grave with remains inside, look different than the surrounding area. So we're ultimately looking at, can we see things visually via drone? And then in the future, we're hoping to expand this to other technologies. Can we use thermal imaging? Can we use hyperspectral imaging? Can we look at changes in the ground surface? And the ultimate goal is to be able to investigate all these technologies and to find a way for law enforcement to be able to find graves with the most cost-effective solution. So to use the least amount of technology to get the most information.
When you're collecting this data on like soil disturbances and you said changes in vegetation, what exactly are you noticing?
So the basic idea is when you dig into the ground, whether you're creating a grave or digging in your backyard, you can never put the soil back exactly the way that it was before. So it's going to hold air and moisture differently. And because of that and nutrients provided by decomposition, we're seeing differences in vegetation growth. So our graves look different than our pits, which is interesting. And they also both look different than the surrounding area. And interesting, we're finding that in soil temperature, our graves are colder than the surrounding soil in colder months. And as it gets warmer from March into the spring and summer, both the graves and the pits are looking warmer than the surrounding area, which means that we're going to be able, and hopefully in the future, to be able to use thermal imaging to detect them.
Wow. UW-Platteville faculty collaborating on forensics education and research on clandestine graves. Sarah Goetz there teaches forensic investigation. Patrick Burns with us in computer science and software engineering. Join in on forensics, combining areas of expertise, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore research underway at UW-Platteville to identify clandestine graves, charting soil differences and drone video footage. The experiments are being done at their outdoor research facility of the university's Forensic Investigation Crime Scene House. Join in on technology breakthroughs for finding unmarked graves and burial sites. 800-642-1234. UW-Platteville's Sarah Goetz is forensic investigation faculty, and Patrick Burns with her is computer science and software engineering faculty. They stay with us. So, Patrick, we've seen drones being used in warfare, drones being used to monitor extreme weather and for so many other uses. Do you think drones in this capacity in, you know, studying crime scenes or, you know, unmarked graves, are they being used to their full capacity at this point, their full capabilities?
Oh, no, absolutely not. I mean, the first and most basic use is in documentation. So a drone can fly over a crime scene and record everything it sees in high fidelity. And that exists as a permanent record of that crime scene. So law enforcement could go back and review that. The question is, do they have effective tools for doing so? Do they have any kind of applications that will automatically process that video and visualize the data in, as I said before, a quick and easy way to digest? And can they make notes? Can they annotate? And they use that in courtrooms. Now, that's not my expertise. I rely on Dr. Goetz for that. But that's what we're working on here. Not only how to process the video in order to extract useful information, but also how do we present that to law enforcement?
What surprises you most here at this point in the research now that you're, you know, about a year in?
Well, we're still in the infancy of this research, but what surprises me most is some of the amazing undergraduate students that I've worked with. So there are challenges with doing undergraduate research. As opposed to a graduate student, undergraduates, they vary in their educational background at this point, which is not surprising. They're going through their undergraduate education. So you can't push too hard. You have to meet them at their level, but the amount that they've accomplished in the last year is that's what's surprising most.
Sarah, how about you? What's coming up for you as this research goes on month by month? What surprised you?
I think the biggest thing that surprised me, other than our students, as Patrick mentioned, is the fact that I expected there to be potentially maybe one approach to this problem. I expected to know what we were going to see. And as the data are coming in, although we only have a very small sample of three graves and three controls at this point, it looks like depending on the season, depending on the depth of the variole, depending on what data we're looking at, we're actually going to need to use completely different approaches looking for different things. And so what turned into one project continuing to the next year could easily become six components to a project. Which is really exciting to give those opportunities to students and as we move forward, but it also creates a lot of complexity.
Why use a pig as a specimen?
So pigs are often used as an analog for humans. They have similar body weight. Their skin is very similar. There's a lot of things that we can't get from pig research, but there are obviously logistical and ethical concerns for creating a human decomposition facility.
Sure. Yes.
So at least in these very early stages, we can get a lot of really good information from pigs as analogs, and then we can collaborate with human decomposition facilities to see whether these results will actually translate in exactly the same way to real-world applications.
And Sarah, UW-Platteville is using its weather station for this grave project. Can you explain the role in the weather station?
Absolutely. So the weather station was funded actually by a university grant for scholarly activity improvement. And we purchased the weather station. It monitors local temperature and rainfall, as well as collecting all of the data from all of those wireless probes that I mentioned in the different areas. And we're actually using that for several different projects on campus, looking at how fingerprints weather over time compared to the temperature and rainfall, and also comparing the data from our weather station to data on campus versus at the airport, because even small fluctuations, differences in temperature and rainfall between close areas that are close, relatively close in geography, can influence our understanding of decomposition. It can change the way that we estimate how long someone has been dead. So it's really important to understand how much those things vary, even within a small area.
How long do you monitor the graves? How long does the study go on?
That's a very good question. We had originally planned on moving our probes to another set of grave sites later this year. But as it turns out, we're still seeing differences between them. So ideally, we'll continue to monitor these for the next few years. And this project will continue to expand as long as we can find the funding for it, which is a perpetual problem. But we hope to be able to apply for state and federal grants based on these data that we've collected. So this project will be around for years to come.
Patrick, what do you make of the interdisciplinary approach to this project? You know, bringing your computer science background, software engineering to this, how do you see that in light of trying to find new discoveries in forensics?
Oh, I'm fascinated by the continual overlap between computer science and all other disciplines. In fact, I just started working with a faculty member in the mechanical engineering department to use drones to measure bridge deformation. And the number of topics that can make use of computer science essentially any topic can make use of computer science. So it gives me an endless supply of research ideas just by bringing my skills to the table.
Talking with Patrick Byrne, Sarah Goetz on their latest research project at UW-Platteville. You can join in on forensic challenges of unmarked graves in this research, 800-642-1234. Sarah, I really want to bring this up because studies have demonstrated that some forensic methods used in criminal investigations cannot consistently produce reliable results. And over the years, we've seen forensic science really come under fire. And we talked on our show with the Innocence Project, their recent book, Junk Science. What is your assessment of this profession?
That is a big question. But as you mentioned, since especially the mid-2000s, there's been this increasing need to reevaluate our methods, to really look at the science that they're built on, to collect more data, and to talk across the disciplines about what we're really doing and what it means for those that are accused in particular. And so I think the discipline is going in a great direction. I think there's more awareness that we need to be very conservative in what we say. We need to have large samples. We need to do good science, ultimately, because our results are not just an academic question. They have real life consequences for those that are accused and for finding information for families that have been waiting to hear about their loved ones.
I want to also turn to a recent program we did on green burials and just kind of seeing what overlap you see there about natural burials. And we talked with Gail Free, who's president of the Viroqua Cemetery Association, spoke to us on new green burial sites.
This is a very conservative farming community, and old farmers who have taken care of their land their entire life see green burial as a common sense approach to their legacy of land stewardship.
Sarah, what connection perhaps do you see between your research and what happens in the green burial process?
I think ultimately this research tells us a little bit more about what we leave behind, what the process of burial actually does when it changes the landscape. Long after most of your body has gone and has decomposed, there's still going to be features of the landscape. You will have made an impact on it, however small. And so I think better understanding that process might be interesting in terms of thinking about green burials and how we use the land and how we interact with it.
Well, Patrick and Sarah, thank you both for joining us. All the best on this research.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Patrick Burns is Assistant Professor of Computer Science and Software Engineering at UW-Platteville, where Sarah Goetz is Assistant Professor of Forensic Education at UW-Platteville and its Criminal Justice and Forensic Investigation Program Coordinator. We have a link to their Forensic Education Crime Scene House at WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.